And of course, Tim Ball with us as we talk about climate change. Let's also get into the fact that a couple lawsuits are pending, going after him. Let's find out why, and we'll take your calls on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Dr. Tim Ball with us. Tim, before we take calls, tell me about these two pending lawsuits. What's going on?
Well, I had two lawsuits brought against me, and they're all by the same lawyer, by the way, in British Columbia here. And the first two, I just said I can't afford to fight it, and I'll withdraw what I said or withdraw the articles. And but then I got two more within 9 days of each other. And my wife and I sat down and said, no, we're not going to be bullied anymore. We don't care if we lose our savings and everything. This is just wrong. And so I decided to fight. And now the people that have brought the lawsuits appear to be dragging their feet. They don't seem to want to go through with it. I think that they were what are generally called slap lawsuits, that is, strategic nuisance lawsuits against public participation, which are allowed in British Columbia. But they are both brought by members of the IPCC. One is Andrew Weaver, who is the guy who did most of the computer modeling. And it's in the computer models, of course, that they created the results that they wanted. And the other is by Michael Mann, who is the guy that cooked up the hockey stick, this graph that showed virtually no temperature change for 600 years and then a sudden turn up in the 20th century. And of course, that was done to get rid of the medieval warm period, because people like myself and Richard Lindzen and others were saying, you're claiming it's warmer now than it's ever been, but it was warmer back in the medieval period when the Vikings were sailing in Arctic waters that are now permanent pack ice. And so those are the two gentlemen that brought the lawsuits against me. And I said, I'm fighting them. But right now, haven't heard anything. And I'm planning to go on the offensive and say, okay, I want my day in court, because what you guys have done is wrong, and I want to be able to show that.
Yeah, you have to fight, Tim. You got to defend yourself.
Yep. And by the way, George, I must say, once people found out what was going on, the money that they provided through PayPal for my legal defense, it's just been phenomenal. And what was really encouraging, I even got support from people that said, look, we don't totally agree with you, but your right to say it has got to be defended.
It sure does. Let's go take some calls here with you. Let's go to Bath, Maine. Kevin's with us. Good morning, Kevin. Go ahead.
Yes, good morning, George and Mr. Balls. My question was, I get the impression that the world, at least the Western world, is moving towards alternative energy. And I'm wondering how we wing ourselves off fossil fuels and still provide people with jobs, because I know fossil fuels, for lack of a better word, fuel a lot of jobs. And I'm wondering how we transition ourselves off of fossil fuels to alternative energy, and yet we keep the current level of employment in the energy sector. And I'll take your answer off the air. Thank you very much.
Sure thing,
Kevin. Yeah, thanks, Kevin. Yeah, of course, the alternate energies were offered as part of the Green Jobs program, and everywhere that it's been tried, it's been a disaster. When you look at Spain, where I think was what cost them $700,000 for each green job they created, and part of the difficulty was, of course, that they touted the alternate energies, solar, wind, and so on, and never did proper cost-benefit analysis of them. And then, of course, with all of the subsidies that went in, it reached a point where it's almost impossible to do proper cost-benefit analysis. And the biofuels, as I mentioned earlier on the program, they fudge the numbers on that. For example, when you burn ethanol, you produce more CO2 than when you burn gasoline. But they claim that, oh, well, you've got to deduct the amount of CO2 the plants take up when they're growing and come up with a net figure. But this is the kind of manipulation that went on. The answer to your question is that there is no need to get off of fossil fuels because CO2 is not causing global warming or climate change. And to reduce our dependence on fossil fuels, because you can argue, well, it's a finite resource, or that it just pays to save money, is fine. But don't do it because of the argument that is causing global warming or climate change, or changes to the environment for that matter. And so what needs to happen is true leadership. Now, there was, it was interesting because when the Senate voted on the Kyoto Protocol, they voted 95-0 against it. And the reason they did was because they said it's going to cost jobs and push the cost of everything up unacceptably. And that's part of the arguments being made now. But the first thing you've got to recognize is that what the IPCC did, demonizing CO2, is completely false, completely wrong. Once you accept that, then you go back, and by the way, they are starting to remove the subsidies from solar and wind and so on, and the biofuels, the subsidies are disappearing. And you see countries like Germany desperately getting back to coal. Britain is doing the same thing. So gradually, there is some sense coming to it, but it needs to be much faster before too much more economic damage is done.
Okay, back to the phones we go. We go to Jack in Monterey, California. Hey, Jack, thank you for calling. Go ahead.
I had a question for Dr. Ball. I started researching aerial spraying, commonly known as chemtrails, and I came across geoengineering, and apparently... one of the ways that the people that believe that it's man-made to combat global warming is by aerial spraying, and the term used is geoengineering. I was just wondering if you knew anything about that.
Yeah, Jack, I know a great deal about that. And of course, the irony of it is that the government were putting up the chemtrails to reduce the amount of energy coming in from the sun to combat global warming. And the people that are opposed to the global warming are also opposed to the chemtrails. So, it seems like you can't do anything right. The truth is we shouldn't be doing any geoengineering at all. The major attempts at it were back in the 70s when global cooling was the threat, and there were all sorts of ideas put forward. One was a proposal to build a dam across the Bering Straits, which supposedly would block cold Arctic waters coming into the North Pacific, that would warm up the middle latitudes and offset the global cooling. There was also ideas about putting huge reflectors up in space and directing sunlight into northern communities during the winter time. So the idea about geoengineering has been around for quite some time. But the more recent one, of course, is to offset the warming, as Jack correctly says. But here's the problem. If you don't know the science, if you don't know what the causes of things are, you're more likely to make it worse. And if you think about back when the cooling was the threat, and let's assume that CO2 causes warming. It doesn't, but let's assume that it does. What would have been the suggestion? Oh, well, let's put CO2 into the atmosphere.
Yeah.
So the geoengineering is humans playing God. If you don't know what you're doing, you're better not to do it.
What about the sun, Tim? Is the sun heating up? And what kind of an effect does it have on us?
Well, the sun is the key to everything. And the sun is not the total source of energy on the planet. We've got geothermal heat coming from within the Earth itself, and that's bubbling up into the oceans and so on. But the IPCC eliminated the sun as a possible source of climate change by their definition, because obviously humans are not affecting sunlight and cannot affect sunlight, but they're only looking at human causes. So things like the change in orbit of the Earth around the sun, the change in the tilt of the sun, what are collectively called the Milankovitch effect, that we know causes climate change, those are not included in the IPCC models. Then also the relationship between number of sunspots and global temperature, which we've known since 1991, is related to the cosmic radiation, which creates low cloud in the atmosphere, and the correlation of that with temperature. None of that is included in their climate models. So the sun explains virtually all that's going on in global temperature, but as I said, the IPCC are simply ignoring it. And by the way, George, the sun reached a peak of activity in the year 2000, has been declining since. The number of sunspots has been dropping significantly. And the scientists that I respect, my own opinion, is this cooling trend we're in is going to continue, and we'll get much cooler up until about 2035 at least.
Wow.
But here's what's interesting, of course, is the government's preparing for warming.
Yeah, they are, in a big way. Ryan's in Seattle. Hey, Ryan, welcome.
You know, all these theories that conservatives come up with, I mean, 10 years ago they said we're going to have a carbon tax. That didn't happen. Then a few months ago people got hysterical saying Obama's coming to take your guns. That didn't happen. Now the guest, and I hear this every single winter, conservatives get all hysterical because they walk outside and it's cold out. They think, oh, the climate change can't be real. You never hear conservatives like this guest during the summer when we have droughts and we have fires and wildfires. And I suppose that since the guest thinks everything's okay, the environment is just fine, he forgets to mention Fukushima. He forgets to mention BP oil. He forgets to mention West Virginia. He forgets to mention all the fracking that's going on. This guy has a political agenda, and I thought Coast to Coast was supposed to be a non-biased show where you have both sides of the point of view.
Well, we've
you
had
seem
both sides.
To only allow guests that have a political agenda, George. And, the American people see right through this. I mean, the American people are turning away from this guest's point of view.
I haven't mentioned politics at all.
You agree with the birthers. You complain about.
No, I didn't. You could completely. All I said was it is a way of marginalizing people that dare to ask questions. That they create these terms like birther or climate change denier and so on. The issues that you've mentioned, like Fukushima and all of those other things, nobody's denying that there aren't those kinds of accidents and problems. But that's very different than the very large problem of saying the whole global climate is changing because of human activity. That's a totally different thing. For you to suggest that I'm a conservative when you haven't got a clue about my political views, you're simply assuming that. And of course, that is a very left-wing approach to things.
Well, and, you know, I've got to tell you, we do have both sides on, Tim. You're not the only kind of climatologist we put on.
Well, no, and of course, we could also argue, George, that how often has this so-called skeptic's view been presented? I think it's very telling I'm at the point now when I make presentations, I say, look, I'm going to give you a biased view because all you've heard up to now is a biased view. You put the two together and draw your own conclusions.
Now, here's my big question to you, Tim. Why do people seem to get so upset with this view, whether it's happening or not? Why can't people have dialogue without losing it?
Oh, exactly. And of course, part of the reason is that the underlying thing is humans shouldn't be on the planet. There, that's part of what that last caller is all about, and he's obviously a left wing view, and he's attacking the conservatives because he assumes that conservatives and their industry and development are all the wrong thing, and it immediately becomes political, and that's the whole point. Why nobody will debate with me. Nobody will debate about the issue, because the minute that you show that what they've been doing is political, they don't want to hear that.
Let's take a few more calls before the break, then we'll come back with more here on Coast to Coast. We've got Joe in Ashland, Oregon. Hey, Joe, go ahead.
Good evening. Boy, I can't believe the timing of you're taking my call. Between 1987 and 2007, I flew between, 200, 300 tours of air tours of Glacier Bay. And I've seen the changes, and we're taught the history in Glacier Bay. There was 5,000 feet of ice in there 600 years ago, mini ice age. Tlingit history will go back to over 1,000 years. But by 1793, when Captain Vancouver came up there, he could go into Icy Straits and on into the inside passage there, the north inside of it, in Lynn Canal. But he described the entrance of what would be Glacier Bay as a three-mile wall of ice. By the middle 1800s, when John Muir was in there mapping that, it had withdrawn up to Adams Inlet and split into the west and east arms of Glacier Bay. I'd point out that was long before greenhouse gases and global, what they call
it. Yep, it's a cycle. It is.
Well, I just wanted to throw that in the pot, you know. On the other hand, I say that after 9/11, and I'm sure Dr. Ball knows this, after 9/11, they sent a U-2 up 24 hours, 72 hours, or 24, 48, and 72 hours after they shut down the flying. And there was a significant increase in the stratosphere temperatures from 3/4 of a degree per night, something like that. So there's the other side of it with a lot of airplanes. Anyway, thank you, gentlemen.
Okay. Yeah, Joe, very, very good observations. I'm going to pull one part out of that. You mentioned the word cycles. The great debate that's gone on in climate over the last 40, 50 years or more is that the West, that is America and Europe, have argued that the weather is chaotic, and therefore that's one of the reasons they argue why it's so difficult to predict. The Russians and the Soviets before them and the Chinese both believe that the weather is cyclical. Now, they have an advantage in that they've got tremendously long records, and I worked with Borisenkov, who's using the Russian chronicles to identify cycles, and they are also believers in the cycles affecting crop conditions and the marketplace. One of the most famous economic cycles is the Kondratiev cycle, which is related to drought in the middle latitudes. And in 1990, there was a conference on this issue, and it split right down the middle, west and east. Of course, it was assumed that this was a Cold War issue, that was a political issue, but it wasn't. It was a genuine scientific difference in the view about the patterns of weather and climate. And I happen to be on the cyclical side because, again, I've used the Hudson Bay Company records and recreated weather over the last 300 years in North America. And you can see the cyclical pattern that's there.
Tim, we're going to come back and take final phone calls with you in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. On our next Coast to Coast program, Steve Quayle joins me as we talk about xenogenesis, what he calls a future of unimaginable horrors created by our planet by unseen masters. Looking forward to talking with Steve about that. We're going to come back with final phone calls and more with Tim Ball on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back, Dr. Tim Ball with us. We'll take your calls. Tim, are you saying that the planet is not warming at all, or are you saying it is, but it's a cycle, folks?
It's a cycle, but there are so many cycles all interacting. So I mentioned the one about changing orbit of the Earth around the Sun. That's a 100,000-year cycle that clearly is a trigger of ice ages. The changing tilt is a 40,000-year cycle. And then there are 11-year sunspot cycles, 22-year sunspot cycles. So sorting them all out, because they all interact with each other, of course, is the great challenge.
And in speak English, then what does that mean?
Well, we don't know all the cycles. For example, we talk about El Nino, that the changing ocean currents that are clearly cyclical. And by the way, they relate to sunspot cycles. Now we know that the Inca knew about them. In fact, they used them for forecasting when they should plant their potatoes, because they related to precipitation patterns. But the challenge is we haven't got very good long-term records. And in fact, the Professor Lamb, who founded that climatic research unit where all the corruption went on, he would have rolled in his grave. I know that because he helped me with my doctoral thesis. But he said, look, until we've got good long-term data sets, we can't possibly start doing all of this analysis of what's driving the weather patterns. And that's the challenge.
Yeah, it is. Let's go to Daniel in Alturas, California. First-time caller for him. Hi, Daniel.
Hi.
Good to have you with us. Go ahead.
Okay. Greenhouse gases. Are they not greenhouse gases after all? They've been lying to us about that, too.
No, every question appears simple, but there's so much complexity behind it. They've identified the three major greenhouse gases, and this should tell you something about the deception. Water vapor is 95% of the greenhouse gases by volume. CO2 is less than 4%, and then methane is less than 0.01%. All you ever hear about is CO2, and I talked about why that became the focus. But the greenhouse gases are gases that they say allow the sunlight to come in, heat the Earth's surface. Then that heat from the surface of the Earth, which is a different wavelength, is slowed down in its escape, and they talk about back radiation, which actually is nonsense. So, yeah, there are greenhouse gases, but all of the focus has been on CO2, and they virtually ignore water vapor. People in the desert know the importance of water vapor as a greenhouse gas because of the range of temperatures that you get with low water vapor.
Didn't we have higher CO2 levels during the prehistoric era anyway, with dinosaurs?
Yeah. Well, as I mentioned earlier, that the temperature changes before the CO2, but when you plot CO2 against temperature over 600 million years, as has been done, there's no correlation whatsoever. And in fact, the current level of CO2 in the atmosphere at 400 parts per million, where Al Gore is claiming that's the highest ever, in fact, it's the lowest ever. Over the last 300 million years, the average has been around 1,200 parts per million. And earlier times, back to before 400 million years ago, the readings were all above 2,000 parts per million and as high as 5,000 parts per million. So, yeah, it's the current levels are very low, and there's no correlation with temperature whatsoever.
Tim, basic question, is there a difference between weather, climate?
Yes, weather is what you experience when you stand outside. And it's the sum total of everything from cosmic radiation in space to heat coming off the bottom of the oceans and everything in between. So that's the immediate experience you have when you're standing outside. The climate is the average of that weather. So if you talk about, say, the climate of California, that's the average weather that California experiences. They try to argue that weather forecasts may be no good, but climate forecasts are good. But if the climate is made up of the weather, if your weather forecast's wrong, your climate forecasts are wrong.
Are people generally afraid of the weather?
Yes. That's why we've got the Chicken Little. The sky is falling. It's a huge fear, and you see that the weather patterns generally in the middle latitudes are about 4 to 6 weeks based upon the wave patterns in the jet stream. But when those wave patterns stall, what the weathermen call blocking, then the weather patterns stretch out to 8, 10, 12 weeks, as we've had recently. And then when the weather doesn't change for over four or five weeks, people start to get quite concerned. So, yeah, and of course, with the drought cycles, for example, people know that's going to affect their food supply. So we're very, very worried about the weather.
Back to the calls we go. We go to Kelly in Moab, Utah. Kelly, go ahead.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Sure.
I just have a quick comment. I work in a high-profile, highly protested oil field right now. So I try to keep myself informed with, you know, certain things. And I listen to Coast almost every night. I work graveyards, so I appreciate that. But, you know, I am totally in agreement with Tim about the cycle issue. A lot of people don't take into consideration. I feel that, you know, the average volcano emits however many, you know, parts of CO2 and whatnot, and this planet is such a powerful force that, I mean, I honestly don't think that there's anything we can do to change what she'll do to us or have her way with us, I guess you could say. I just think it's silly that people get so upset and heated, you know what I mean?
Well, Kelly, you know, there's almost an arrogance, you know, that we say, oh, well, look, we screwed up the planet. Aren't we clever? We're almost childlike in our attitude about that. And so it's, of course, part of the one of the interesting things that's gone on over the years. I've been invited by religious groups to explain climate change to them, because they get very angry when the priest in the pulpit is talking about the weather and climate change, and we've got to change. The average parishioner's view is, look, render unto Caesar what is Caesar's, and render unto God what is God's. And there's something very arrogant about claiming that we can change the weather, and I agree with you on that. Incidentally, the amount of CO2 that humans produce on an annual basis is calculated by the IPCC, so that's very self-serving. They estimated last year that it was 9 gigatons, and that sounds like a lot. But that's actually within the error of our estimate of how much CO2 is produced by the oceans every year and how much is produced by rotting soil and vegetation. So when we start to look at the numbers that they assign to humans, they're fractional compared to nature's numbers.
What are they teaching in the universities to prospective climatologists?
Of course, that's the problem. They're not teaching climatology. They're teaching climate science, and there's a difference. A climatologist is somebody who looks at the pattern of weather in a region or the change of weather over time, and only when you do that do you start to see the larger picture. A climate scientist is somebody who is, say, an expert in, let's say, a physicist who happens to look at the physics of CO2 or the physics of the sun. So they're only looking at one small piece of a very, very large puzzle. And that's why, of course, when you asked me earlier about these people, like a meteorologist, for example, they study physics of the atmosphere. And so they're only looking at one portion of a thing, but it's not until you step back and look at the whole picture that you really understand what's going on.
Let's go to Robert in Vancouver, Canada, on our international line. Robert, go ahead.
Hi, how you guys doing?
Good, Robert. Appreciate it.
As you know, Vancouver is just it's the center of ridiculousness with all these subjects. One of the big subject in the city is sustainability, particularly with food. You know, but the city is very at risk for power because we bring power in from hundreds and hundreds of kilometers away.
Yeah.
Now, my idea is to build a coal plant smack in the middle of the city. And the idea is that Vancouver is surrounded by huge fields of coal. Now, if you did that, tons of research would be piled in to make coal clean so that there'd be absolute, you know, clean emissions and everyone would be happy. And if you ask me, instead of focusing on solar energy and wind power, if research was put into coal power to make it clean, that would solve so much globally, like with what's happening in China, with what's happening in India, with all these coal plants. Why aren't people focusing on making those major, quote-unquote, facilities of generating CO2 and focus on those? Because that, in my mind, that would have the biggest impact of anything in reducing
things. I'll tell you one thing too, Robert. Coal is not in people's favor right now. Go ahead, Tim.
Yeah, well, and of course, President Obama said that you can build the coal plant, but I'll tax you out of existence. He's had a battle against the coal industry. And that has been pushed, by the way, by James Hansen, who was the head of NASA GIS, the climate section of NASA. And he was arrested as a bureaucrat for protesting against coal production. But to Robert's point, there was years ago a coal burning plant in the middle of the campus of William and Mary University. It was an experimental one. The students didn't even know it was a coal burning plant. And they were, of course, experimenting with burning coal clean. And Mr. Murray and two other coal producing companies built a plant in North Dakota that burns coal completely clean. It has been suppressed or pushed aside and ignored. I guess political reasons, but the ability to burn coal clean has been around for some time. Now, it would cost more, but I think people would be willing to pay that to have clean burning coal. And so Robert's view is absolutely right, but it's been identified as the great demon by people like Obama. And as you correctly point out, Robert, while the Chinese are building, I believe it's something like 2 coal burning plants a week that they're under construction. Germany's back to building coal burning plants again because of the energy shortages that they've got. But Robert's on to something.
Let's go to Kevin now in Omaha, Nebraska. See what's up with Kevin. Go ahead, Kev.
Oh, good morning, gentlemen. I'm not informed enough to debate climate science with a PhD, but my thrust of my question is, how does he weigh being dismissive of green energy against the slavish nature of petroleum industry to profit? What's going on up in North Dakota right now is going to affect the landscape and the environment there for centuries to come, because they are dumping radioactive material wherever they can under the darkness and secrecy of night and out of the prying eye of the public. And it's purely for profit. They don't want to pay to mitigate that.
Sure.
So Kevin, I was in Fargo, North Dakota about 3 months ago. The lieutenant governor spoke at the conference I spoke at, and he warned. He said, "Look, this is a great thing for North Dakota right now. We've got the lowest unemployment rate. Our economy is booming, but have no illusions about the long term effects of these things." So they're aware of it. But I pointed out to that audience that 20 years earlier, two Rutgers professors had said, look, the Dakotas are absolutely useless. There's no work. There's nothing going on. You're better to get rid of all the people and give it back to the buffalo. And yet now you see that it's booming. But people are aware of the limitations of these things. I'm not opposed to green energy. Green energy is fine. What I'm opposed to is the subsidies to supposedly make it seem like it's competitive with fossil fuels, and the corporate corruption that went on with Solyndra and all of that, and the failure to do proper cost-benefit analysis. Because what people don't realize with wind power, for example, first of all, they're great. The number of birds they're killing, even the German Greenpeace Party estimate 35 million birds a year.
Wow.
But What people don't realize is that when you've got wind power, you have to have what's called spinning generation running all the time, because if the wind drops off, the surge on the grid system is so great that it'll shut it down. Denmark limits the amount of wind power to 12% because of that problem. So none of these issues about the limitations of green energy or the true cost of them has ever been put out there, and that's the problem that I have with it.
Let's get one or two more calls in. Anthony is in Salem, Oregon. Go ahead, Anthony. Thank you.
Hello, how you doing, George?
Good,
and, Dr. Ball. Excellent. I'm sorry to make a question here. The whole climate change thing, it's big money, and there's some serious cash being thrown around, and the same thing I kind of noticed, and now this might be a little controversial, is evolution. Is, you know, it gets crammed down our throats when we're kids, and, you know, we begin to think something's an absolute fact, and never really seen evolution. And the same thing with climate change. You know, there's big money, and my question is who's behind that big money? And you know, do you have any insight on that?
Well, of course, you know, I think it was Rush Limbaugh, wasn't it, that said follow the money, and I suppose that's always true.
I said that.
Oh, did you, George? Okay, well, I'll give you the credit for
always
that.
Always follow the money.
Always follow the money, yeah. It's very interesting because I've been accused of getting money from oil companies. I've never received a nickel, I wouldn't invest in an oil company that wasn't doing climate research, because that's what determines the demand for their product. So it seems logical that they would do that R&D, but they're condemned for it. But if somehow, if Greenpeace are funding climate research, that's okay. Or if government's funding climate research, that's okay. So the money affects everything and determines everything, including who's getting the finger pointed at them. But the distortions, as I said, with the green energies, the subsidies distort the picture so much that you really can't sort things out anymore.
Tim, your website, of course, is linked up at coasttocoastam.com for everyone. And the book, The Deliberate Corruption of Climate Science, still available?
Absolutely, and they can link to it from my website. It's available through Amazon or through Kindle.
All right, Tim. Thanks for being on the program. I appreciate it. Dr. Tim Ball. For Dan Galante, Tricia Pepe, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Laudasur, Stephanie Smith, Chris Boros, George Knapp, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.